Hello, and welcome to another virtual author chat at the Poison Pen Bookstore. I'm John Charles, and today I'm especially delighted to have with us one of my very favorite authors in the world, Minerva Spencer, whose new book, The Dueling Duchess, has just been published this May. Before we begin our chat, I'd like to let those listening in know that the Poison Pen does have copies of Minerva's new book, as well as some of her backlist, and we would be happy to hold them for you or put them in the mail. Just give us a call or go online to the Poison Pen bookstore, and we can connect you with these fabulous books. Now I'd like to welcome Minerva Spencer.
Thank you for having me here. I'm so glad. I didn't get to come and see you this year, so this is my virtual visit.
Yes, it's not quite the same, but it's better than nothing. Why don't we start? I always find it interesting to know about the author before they became a published writer, and you have what I'd like to call a rather eclectic resume.
Yes, I did. Before starting writing, I had a five-year attention span, so I did a lot of things for 5 years. I think I'm now, well, I guess my first book was published in 2018, so I'm right a little bit at 6 years now. Uh-huh. Is that right? Is my math right? I was not a mathematician anywhere in there. Mm-hmm. I have taught college history, and I was a criminal prosecutor for a while, mm-hmm. owned a bar, and also a bed and breakfast, not at the same time, but did that for 8 years. That was the last thing I did before writing with the bed and breakfast, and currently live in the bed and breakfast that we can't sell because the bed and breakfast market kind of went the way of, buggy whips and everything else. Changes. So
do you think that, I mean, it may sound crazy, but all those different careers that you kind of indulged in or took part in before becoming a writer, maybe each of them kind of helped hone a different part of your writing muscles. Like, I'm thinking if you're a history professor, that may kind of help you with your interest in history, historical research, kind of setting scenes. If you're a prosecutor, you have to think logically about shaping arguments, and does that impact your writing? If you're a bartender, you've heard a lot of stories from people.
Yes. Oh, for sure. I mean, I always find it fascinating when people say in their biographies or writing biographies, oh, I knew I wanted to be a writer from a very young age. Mm-hmm. And I didn't think, I guess I was raised by a child of immigrants. So my parents didn't encourage me in stuff like, be a writer or an actor or whatever. They were like, be a lawyer, you know, be something that you can actually get employment. So, but I guess along the way, I wrote enough that it just seemed like when I wrote my first historical romance, which was Barbarous, the writing just came really easily. And I think that was from years of writing stuff that, I mean, I remember writing a law school paper, and I got, it was probably the highest grade I got in law school. And the professor wanted to publish it. He said, you've managed to make filial responsibility law somehow really engaging. And I thought, well, that's a good thing, you know? So I think that, these jobs all had, with the exception of the last two, which were bartending and inn owning, they had a component of a lot of heavy duty writing. So at least I could get my, the grammatical and structural aspects of writing, which I'm so grateful that I went to school for all these, different subjects, because it really did give me that grounding. And I think that's one of the few things that's very hard to catch up on if you don't have it starting as a writer. But
so you decided you wanted to become a writer about 2013 or so?
Yeah, I think it was November of 2013. We were just closing our inn. Oh. And so
And you did not go the traditional route, if I remember correctly. You went the contest route. Can you kind of explain that to those that don't know about?
Well, back then, the RWA, which the Romance Writers Guild, had a bunch of different chapters across the world, I guess. They had them everywhere. And they offered contests for unpublished writers. And now I look at it and I would be afraid to do it. Because, I mean, you're really setting yourself up for a lot of criticism. And I think, a lot of the judges were contemporaries. So a lot of people weren't really qualified to judge you, and yet they did. And as a young newbie writer, you think, oh, that one bad review is, oh no, the book is no good. And mm-hmm. it's only after 5 or 6 years of kind of being battered by the review process that you realize if you go on Goodreads or any of those review sites, you'll see that, even William Shakespeare gets a one-star review. So, but yeah, I think the contest route really kind of toughened me up and got me to send out some, to query some of my books, which was something that I had really been dragging my heels on, so.
Yeah, apparently you had kind of a phobia of query letters, or what was going on there?
I can write a couple, you know, 400-page book, no problem, but a tight, succinct, one-page, three-paragraph query letter is, and I, honestly, the way that I wrote it was by, I found a Sherry Thomas blog post on how she wrote her query letter, and she put the, I don't know if it's still out there, but if any aspiring authors are looking for a query letter, she just really nailed it, and it helped that I had read the book and loved it, mm-hmm. So I could read the query letter and judge it against the book and go, okay, yeah, she really did, you know, so that's kind of, she saved my bacon there, that's for sure. She didn't even know me.
No, she's an amazing writer, and in some ways you kind of are parallels, because you both were not writing traditional historicals. Her first book was quite different from what was out on the market. Private Arrangements, I think, was the title. And your first book was not the normal flavor of the month in the 2010s or so.
No, it wasn't. It was people keep saying to me, it was funny at the time, they said, oh, your writing is so retro. And I had only ever read Georgette Heyer, Victoria Holt, a couple Tessa Dares, and Sherry Thomas. But I hadn't read really widely, so I didn't realize that. I mean, I still haven't read the stuff from the golden age of bodice rippers, you know, like Rosemary Rogers or Patrice Small or whatever. I keep thinking I should read that stuff, and still haven't done it. But yeah, it people said it was kind of a throwback style. I think maybe I have thought about what that means, like trying to read between the lines on that. My beta reader often tells me, remember, this is a romance. When I get too gritty and focus on things that are, you know, he's good at pulling me back into line and saying, that's what you know, you want to focus on that. So I think that maybe when people say I'm retro, I do look at a bit more of a grittier reality, which those early ones were pretty tough, right? From what I've heard.
Yeah. And I think it's I would take it as a compliment if I was a writer in many ways, because it means you're not afraid to be a little bit different. I mean, one criticism I might have of, and not being a writer, it's easy for me to criticize, as people say, the current state of romance historical writing is sometimes it seems like everybody wants to write the same story. Maybe it's because that's popular and publishers are saying don't color outside the lines because you won't get as many readers or it's if I hear Bridgerton one more time, nothing against she, and in her books, I mean, she created something unique and different, and to her credit, it's very much in her voice, but not everyone can be Bridgerton. You have to be who you are as a writer.
I agree with you. I really think she kind of blew everything wide open for, you know, exposed a lot of people who hadn't read historical romance to it, and it's really increased the readership. However, yeah, I mean, I've been marketed by my publisher as being, if you like Bridgerton, you'll like Minerva Spencer. And it's like, well, I mean, I don't really write like her, you know, and my books aren't ballroom kind of.
Yeah, there's an intensity to your writing that I wouldn't necessarily say is in Julia Quinn's, but she has a touch with humor that might not be something that's your strong suit. Every writer is got their own skill set that they're working with. And I think the key thing is, how do you use your literary tools most effectively? And I think that's what you've done with your stories, which brings us to your new book, The Dueling Duchess. What can you tell us about this book?
Yeah, when I was thinking about today and talking about this book, I tried to think, how many books ago was it that I wrote this? And I think it's like 6 books ago. Well, I could tell you some kind of little interesting. Here's the book. Mm-hmm. Sure, the cover. First of all, the heroine is named after my my grandmother, who just passed away last November. But I thought she would have enjoyed. She read romance. She preferred Harlequin romances my romance, but that's all right. I wasn't grudgy. She read only in French.
Oh.
She didn't speak English. And so I was really excited the first time my works got translated into French, and she read that. Anyway, this is my homage to my grandmother, who was definitely a tough old bird. And the character in The Dueling, that just is, she's an older heroine, so she's in her mid-30s. And I guess I'm thinking about the other characters in this book. I guess two of the three heroines are older, which allows me to do something different with them too. I think they're not on that common trajectory of, you know, have your season, get a man, whatever. And the stories are definitely very, the characters are interrelated. However, I do think that you can, it's hard for me to say, can you read the second one without having read the first one? And
You can. I mean, in theory, romances, whether they're part of a series or not, stand on their own because the focus is on that relationship between the couple in that particular book. I think in the case of The Dueling Duchess, which is the second, your first book in the trilogy, I think, was The Boxing Baroness.
Mm-hmm.
You have kind of an overarching thematic story element that kind of you can see coming up in book two. It was started in book one. So, I mean, purists, and there are reading purists out there that, yeah, you're going to have to probably read them in order. Otherwise, I can hear you gnashing your teeth. But no, I mean, if you only read one book, you would perfectly enjoy The Dueling Duchess. I think what's interesting is there will be some people, there'll always be people who criticize authors and say, this is not realistic, because the books are about the women in Farnham's female?
Fantastical female fair, yeah.
Yeah, which is kind of like a circus, but with an emphasis on a female kind of entertainment performers. There were actually historical precedents for some of what you're using, like there were female pugilists.
And the reality of what these kind of variety acts is what they were. Mm-hmm. And, you know, especially when I was researching for The Boxing Baroness, the reality of it was really ugly, because Regency men, Victorian men, a lot of modern men will pay to watch anything fight.
Yeah.
And so women were trotted out as kind of, here's a sideshow, you know, have a woman fighting a dog or fighting each other, or, you know, dressed in a certain way. And so, yeah, I mean, variety acts have been around forever. That when I looked up circuses, I realized that the circus as we understand it is not, it's a pretty modern construct. That's like mid-Victorian, I think. But throughout, you know, the Middle Ages, there were traveling groups who would go set up in a town and show them whatever. So in terms of, you know, were there people who did this kind of stuff? Sure. Were they women? Some of them were, and, you know, and it was in the seamier underworld that these people were forced to perform. There is a woman that was referred to as the Dueling Duchess, and that just is about a duel that took place between two aristocratic women. So that doesn't really have anything to do with this, other than to show that, yeah, every once in a while, an aristocratic woman would have had enough and would do something that probably shredded her reputation for the rest of her life. Realism in historical romance is a really interesting concept, because, you know, most of us at the age of 30, 40, 50, if we didn't have the benefit of modern science, wouldn't be looking so good.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you think about these people, you know, yeah, in her mid-30s, a woman probably would have been pretty rough looking,
mm-hmm.
you know, in 18, 14, 15. But I guess I like to, skate that line between to have a realistic interpersonal relations, I guess, maybe a little bit more of, and less realism on certain aspects, though.
Well, I think you do build a case for your protagonists in each of your books. I think in The Dueling Duchess, is that the one where her family were gun manufacturers involved?
Right.
Yeah,
Royal gun manufacturers.
And I'm sure that, I mean, there probably were families that did that where the women did help out in the business, because that's, I mean, it's not like in some places you could find all the skilled labor you needed or that they had the money to hire workers. So I'm sure women and some women did a lot of things in Regency period that often we don't realize. And Jana McGregor has done a series that about women merchants who ran businesses and things like that, like clothing, linen supplies and shipping and things like that. Just because it wasn't every woman in Regency period doesn't mean it is impossible, I guess, is what we have to accept as readers.
And certainly when I went looking for one of my research rabbit holes was looking for women in the munitions industry, wondering like, okay, who's making this stuff for the Napoleonic Wars, right? And there, I talked to a librarian from the Library of Congress and she sent me what she could find. And she said, you know, there's not anybody mentioning this. And again, that's really important to consider that, well, we can extrapolate based on the World War II, which we do have lots of information from, and who participated in the munitions industry during the war. Well, it was the women, because the men were. So yeah, I mean, there's a lot of stuff that is not there, not because it didn't happen, but it's just nobody thought it was worth mentioning. And a lot of these people, you know, who did these sorts of jobs were illiterate. So they're not gonna leave a record either.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think you kind of your historical romances kind of are that bridge between you provide the romance, but there's also a lot of history and things for readers to dig into there too.
Yeah, I love setting this on the period when Napoleon got off of Elba, because it's just such an inconceivable thing, you know. It's like it's such a gentler age where when you're done with your foe, you know, you don't kill them or whatever. You send them to an island in the Mediterranean, like cross your fingers and hope that he's just quiet. And so that was a lot of fun. And just imagining, you know, what the French must have been through after they'd had a couple of months with the king back and realizing, hey, any post-war period is tough, right? But when you change out the ruler with somebody else, you know, they're going to have to answer for a lot. And so, yeah, they welcome this guy back who's just been, for two decades, has been messing everyone's life up and welcome him back with open arms.
Yeah, history, the more things change, the more things they stay the same. It seems.
It is, it's terrifying. So that was a lot of fun. I enjoyed that, especially.
Now, this is the second, and there will be a third, if I understand correctly.
Yes, the Cutthroat Countess.
Okay.
And so that's the knife-throwing woman. And of all the books, I would say she is the most based on an individual. Oh. And that I found this really interesting source material for women spies during the Napoleonic era. And that it referenced two women by name. And one of them in particular would dress as the cabin boy and help to relay messages that way. And so, yeah, there are women again. And we just got lucky that these two got mentioned, you know.
Yeah, it's, well, I guess a parallel would be the female spies in the Civil War in America. Mm-hmm. You think that that's totally a man's war, but women really were doing so many things, whether it was nursing or spying or dealing with other things. Yeah, history, that's one of the things I love about history. In addition to The Dueling Duchess, you have another book coming out this month under a different literary ego?
I do. Today, actually, is the launch day for, and I write under my real name as well, which is S.M. Laviolette. And somebody just wrote me recently, sent me an email and was really concerned as to why I had three different pen names. I mean, a reader who just couldn't rationalize, I said, well, at first I thought the books written under this name were like this. And then I thought it was this, but now I've read some and they're just like that. So why? And as you know, it's usually it's something that a publisher insists on is you write
it. Actual, yeah.
Mm-hmm. So, the book today, Balthazar, is kind of I'm stepping off in a different direction. It's set in the Victorian era, and it also starts in a commune in upstate New York. So mid 19th century was a big time for religious utopian movements.
Right. Wasn't there like two great awakenings or something like that? Or
Yeah, the first one early in the century, and then 1830s, and then later on. So this was the Oneida colony, which a lot of people have heard of because it started off as a commune, right? A free love. Boy, they had some. I mean, it's so funny because a lot of their beliefs they're super racy today. You know, I mean, I read a book written by a descendant of the founder of Oneida. She's a historian at, I think it was North Carolina University. And she wrote History of Oneida, the Commune from Religious Utopia to a Well-Set Table, I think what the title is. Because they make cutlery and...
That's right. Yeah, I was trying to figure out why does that keep ringing a bell? It's like, yeah.
Yeah. So that's how they were a commune. I think it was from 1840, early 1840s to the 1880s. So one of the longest lived ones. And initially I was going to use the Oneida commune as my commune. And then after reading her book, I felt like, gosh, you know, here's a descendant. I don't want to go in there and start messing around with. Well, the family has been super freaked out about their relationship to this commune because the word commune, of course, root word of communism. Mm-hmm. And so back in the, I can't remember now, I think it was the 1940s when the Red Scare was going on in the
1950s. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And they went and took all of the documents from the commune, the family did, and burned them all.
Oh.
So there's nothing left of this amazing little section of history, you know, but they were afraid of being accused of having communist connections. And also ashamed of, I mean, you know, it was a free love colony. So no marriage. They considered it group marriage. All kinds of stuff. So that was my starting point. And I made up my own commune that way. I'm not besmirching anything real. And there were also some discoveries I made in reading about this one that were not so, I was
family, not really.
Yeah, even I was a little bit shocked. So, so this family, there's six kids in this book, I mean, in this series, and so there'll be a book for each kid. And five of them have been raised at the commune, and one is the child of a different mother. And so he got raised somewhere else. He's raised by a really puritanical banking family from New York, one of the, you know, what is that, the 10,000?
4,000?
4,000. Yeah. I can't remember. One's in Britain.
400. It's the 400 in New York. Okay.
Yeah. And so he's like raised super proper. And he's got these five siblings who were raised at, you know, this free love commune. And the oldest brother discovers that he is heir to a dukedom in England. Oh. And so he goes and takes his five siblings and hauls them over to England.
And what's the title of this book?
Balthazar Despair.
Oh, that sounds fascinating. And you just brought something up that probably other brighter minds have thought about, but this whole idea that there's a certain part of the country that want to return to a time when history was so pure and straightforward and things like that. If they really knew what was going on in American history, they would not be that burning books and doing things now to try to make it seem like the past was a better place, more straightforward place, I guess.
Yeah, when I was getting my degree in history, I remember I read a book called The Way We Never Were. And it talks about that. It talks about this nostalgia that we always have, especially for the Victorian era, which is like a really brutal era. You know, mm-hmm. It's like, oh, you're nostalgic for, I don't know, selling your kids to a, you know, a chimney sweeper for a couple of bucks, right, at the age of 10 or something. So yeah, it's definitely, I think that for sure these communes, these utopian communities represented a really small percentage of the population. Mm-hmm. And I mean, it's fascinating to think of just how they functioned within greater society, right, when they're doing this stuff. And you know, they're in farm country. Oneida was in farm country. So here you are out in the middle of a bunch of farmers and you're getting up to who knows what in this commune, you know, it was, yeah, there was some hot times going on. So that was really fun for me to move this family from that. And then, so now you're going to have not just the culture shock of going to the UK, but there's also this added component of like the oldest daughter is a proponent of birth control and distributes condoms. which in the 1870s was, you know, that's pretty shocking. Mm-hmm. Pretty shocking now, actually.
Mm-hmm. let's talk a little bit about your writing, because you are incredibly driven. You're both published traditionally with Kensington, and now you've been for a while, if I remember correctly, doing your own books independently. What is that like? I mean, do you find that there's certain things you can do as an indie published author you can't as a traditionally published author? What are the advantages? Are there disadvantages? How on earth do you write so many books? Do you just not do anything but write all day long?
Yeah, it's definitely taken over my life more than like 4 years ago. I mean, I definitely write a lot more, you know, and God, the weird thing is like, as much as I write, I'll be in the middle of something and another book idea will come into my head. So I'll have to stop and just write a couple of pages and say, hey, this is the book idea. I mean, I have a file that probably has 200 book ideas in it. Does the book about this, book idea about this. And so as much as I publish, so this year I have 8 books coming out. I have 2 science fiction.
Wow.
And then, the other 6 are historical romance, predominantly Regency, 1 Victorian. And, you know, I just keep having more ideas. I've started writing a couple of contemporaries that I really want to get out there, but I've got such a tight publishing schedule now that it's like, I've done this to myself. So I am my publisher and I've kind of stitched me up in this, but.
And I think it's probably good to interject at this point that all writers are different. So your writing schedule is what works for you. That doesn't mean that everybody can or should write this number of books per year. There are some writers who it takes them 2 or 3 years to write a book, and that's just their process. So the process is different to each individual artist.
That is for sure. And I've never given talks on writing, and I doubt I ever will, because I feel very strongly that everybody's method is, you have to go with what feels right for you. And I think there are a lot of people out there who will tell you, here's how you be more productive or how you do whatever. And it's like, God, you know, don't listen to that, because that's part of you're going to come out in your book, your individual, you know, whatever you're writing is, you're going to come out in it. So be yourself when you're writing. Don't let anyone else tell you how to write. You know, I mean, when I think back to some of those contests where I had, you know, I had judges who were agents and editors at publishing houses, and some of them hated my stuff, you know, and they'd say, oh, this book doesn't start in the right place or whatever. Well, and then later on, that was the book that Kensington bought, you know? So yeah, just write what you want, how you want to write it. And there is no formula. I mean, and when you start thinking there's a formula for success, I think then you should be making widgets or something. Mm-hmm. So.
Yeah, I think that's another important point that you brought up. Part of becoming a successful writer is luck and timing. And your book may not resonate with a particular editor if you're going the traditional route, but that doesn't mean the book itself is bad. Sometimes the book is bad. Let's just be right up front and say there are books out there that no one wants to read other than perhaps your mother or someone in your family. But sometimes it's just you don't click, your work doesn't click with the right connection at that point in time.
I think that to me is a devastating thing for a lot of people, is that I went to my very first writer's conference, and there was a woman who was in a group with me. And what we did is we gave 10 pages in advance to an agent who read it, critiqued it. And then we all talked about it in this 4-hour session. And so I read these other people's stuff, and by and large, most of it was just awful. And there was this one piece of work that was just, it made me feel like, oh man, mine's not nearly as smart and good and literary as that. And this woman sat there, and the agent who was supposed to be providing guidance like tore her stuff down. I could not believe it. Just, she got up and left crying. And I went and found her afterward, and I said, man, I don't know about that woman, but I thought it was amazing. And it was, I want to read more. And it turns out she eventually got a contract for her book. Yeah. It's called Rosary Without Beads. Mm. It's set in Southern New Mexico, but just a beautiful story. It's not a romance. It's, I'd say, literature, Southwestern literature. But, you know, so there's somebody who had this terrible experience, and she could have stopped, you know, and it would have all been somebody's opinion. Just who's supposed to be a professional, you know?
Well, yeah, that there's a lot of definitions of professional, but yeah, I think that's another, for people that are listening that are aspiring writers who are thinking about it, writing is tough. I mean, it's a tough business. You have to be able to endure kind of those potential hurdles. You also have to be willing to put in the work. There's some people who like the idea of being a writer, the glamour, which is really illusion, anything else. But if you aren't willing to do what you're doing, which is like sit down every single day or whatever your schedule is and put in the hours, then maybe you're just in love with the idea of being a writer, but you don't really want to be a writer.
I actually had a good conversation about this with somebody. Jeffy Kennedy is a friend of mine. Who,
yeah, I did not know that.
Yeah, and she just saved me on this recent book. It was one of those times when I needed somebody to step in and tell me what to do. And she said, you need to cut the first 86 pages of this book. And I was hating her a lot. And but that was absolutely what I needed to do. And we were discussing the whole process of, it was the first time I've given somebody a not ready to read copy, because I wanted her to tell me, hey, something's wrong here and it doesn't feel right. What is it? And we were discussing that you only ever really know what's going to happen in your book when you write the ending. There's something about getting to the ending point that helps you to understand all the stuff you've written before. That first draft is just that, right? It's just a raw draft. And you have to know where the story is going to go before you can go back and, you know, that's when you put in the second and third and fourth edit. You put in the humor, you put in, you know, nuances or whatever. But yeah, you have to finish the book. And that is one of the things that you can't get around that as an author, you know, no matter how much you think you want to polish up that first section yet again, no, just got to finish it. So whether it takes you 3 years or 3 months or however long, you know.
Yeah. Or in your case, 3 days, but.
This book just about killed me this recent one. Cutting 86 pages out of the beginning of a book was a real weird experience. I mean, basically then you just got to figure out all that information that you just put in needs to go in somehow.
Yeah. So do that. Being indie published doesn't mean you're just a writer. You also have to think in terms of business, the business of publishing. So are you responsible for like your covers, for your cover copy, for editing, all that? Do you rely on other people? Is it you take on everything? Talk about indie publishing from your perspective, what it involves from the business side, so people who might be interested might get a little bit more information.
I do everything, because I honestly, a lot of it is because I couldn't find the people to provide the service for me. I would love to hand my advertising over to somebody. That is the biggest waste of time. I mean, and I know it's not a waste, but I mean, it is a consumer of time just trying to understand, you know, where to spend my advertising dollars. And then I've made the covers for this recent two series, and they have been so popular that when I sold the audio rights, the Tantor Audio, they asked to use the covers that I made.
Wait a minute. So you actually drew the covers, or you're the artist behind them, or?
Yes.
I mean, I don't know why I'm surprised, because you're like the most crafty people in the world, knitting and all these other things. And yeah.
I think this is my favorite cover. I think it just really
captures the book. Yeah.
So, yeah. And I've learned how to use it. It's taken about 2 years to learn how to use the open source graphic design software. It's like Photoshop, but free. And that's also been an outlet creatively for me, because I like to craft a lot, but I needed to craft stuff that was going towards this book or my book. And I can't do real people like this. Mm-hmm. So the covers that I have that have real people on them, I pay company to make them for me. Mm-hmm. But I think, you know, it's very hard, I would say, as a new self-publisher to get noticed in the sea of, you know, you hear various statistics for how many books are self-published per month.
I think it's like 500,000 last year or something like that.
It's horrifying.
Yeah.
but yeah, there are a lot of things that you need to do to kind of manage that. And I would say that you got to decide what's going to go by the wayside. And for me, social media, which is just a mysterious process, is something that I have just decided I just can't do it. You know, I can do my advertising, I can write the books, but.
Well, you do have a website though.
I have a website. Yeah. And that's something that I try to keep it current and keep in, you know, information that people would like. But in terms of Facebook or Instagram or TikTok, or, you know, and I feel like a lot of people will tell you, oh, authors need to have all the social media presence. And it's like, well, if you're not feeling it, it's going to show, I think.
Yeah, that's it. You have to do what's right for you. And there are some people that are natural at social media, and we'll just say the name Christina Dodd, but not everyone is a Christina Dodd when it comes to doing those TikTok things or whatever it is.
I know. And I thought when TikTok came out, I'm like, oh, I just barely understand Facebook. And now there's another one, you know? So, and I try not to beat myself up that I can't do that as well. And, so anyway, I would say to people who are new to self-publishing that to pick a couple of things to focus on and, you know, don't feel like you have to do all of it.
Yeah.
Although, yeah, you are going to have to delegate if you don't. And I don't expect everybody wouldn't do their covers, for example.
No, and there are, I mean, today indie publishing is light years ahead of what it was 20 years ago. There are reputable firms that you can do, get covers, that can do copy, that can do editing. So aspiring writers should always, of course, check the bona fides of whoever they're working with, but they have much more options now. And the final product is much more polished, and we shouldn't judge a book by a cover, but let's face it, we all do. So that's important to make sure it looks good.
Well, and especially in romance, you mentioned like there are other alternatives, and that is something that I would also suggest to a newbie would be to submit their stuff to author-owned presses like Dragon Blade, which is owned by Catherine Levesque, and Oliver Heber, which is Kerrigan Byrne, and I don't remember who. Woman's name is slipping my mind. It's terrible. I have a terrible memory. But yeah, so two authors own Oliver Heber, and then Penny Reed, who does, of course, the Smarty Pants.
There was also Bell Books, I think, or something like that. Author owned. That was a while back, but
yeah, so you can, and they definitely have a more author oriented approach to publishing. You know, they've been there, so they're a lot more sympathetic, and often the deals are better too.
Yeah, and also they realize that your book may be appropriate for 1,000 readers, which is why a smaller indie press can help you get that to those readers. It might not be worthwhile for Penguin, who's trying to sell 10,000 copies or something like that.
Yeah, for sure. So there are a lot of options. And I'm sure eventually I'll be finished with doing my whole, you know, running the whole band, and I'll turn it over to somebody at some point. But right now I'm really loving it. So
that's the important thing, that because it shows in the writing. Now, because you pretty much don't do anything but write, I will ask, as a reader, is there anything that you've read that you want to share with people? Is there something on your summer reading list that you're dying to get into when you have time? What about Minerva as a reader?
Well, I try to read outside of the genre that I'm writing in. So I haven't, you know, I haven't read very much historical romance in a long time, to be honest. What have I read lately? I read a couple of books by Freida McFadden. Have you heard about her? The Housemaid is one that was like...
Sounds vaguely familiar, but...
I kind of can't believe how... I was a little bit skeptical because I don't usually read stuff. If something's really popular, chances are I'm going to read it and go, meh. But I read this and I got sucked in and read the whole thing, like, well, in one sitting, basically. Yeah, The Housemaid. And she's probably got 10 or 15 books out, but mysteries are a good escape for me. I also like a lot of contemporary. I've been reading a lot of mobster romances.
I mean, I've seen that. There's trying to think of one of the authors that does the Irish mob series that
The woman that I was reading is Sophie Lark, who does hers is a set in Chicago.
Oh, okay.
And so it's a convergence of the Russian, Irish, and Italian mafias. Those are a lot of fun. I never thought I would like that. Of course, you know, the realist in me is thinking it's funny to read these books that deal with mafia activity and they keep out the unsavory stuff like child porn and you know, sex drugs, slavery and all this stuff. Because these mafia dons don't do that.
Well, but in a way, I mean, it is fiction. So you have to give authors some leeway. And I mean, they're coming from, but even though you don't read historicals, aren't these like the billionaire CEOs and the mob bosses? They're the modern day equivalents of the dukes and things.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yes. And I have, I caved into the, I wrote what I think of as a billionaire Victorian. You know, the word millionaire was coined, an American word coined in the mid 19th century, I think. And so, yeah, I used the term millionaire in one of my historicals for the first time. The modern reader probably doesn't notice that. Yeah, that's a pretty unusual word to throw around back then. A million of anything.
Yeah, it would be. I'm sure that you, like many authors, there are the occasional readers that will sometimes quibble and say this isn't historically accurate when it turns out that it actually was. It just wasn't common or known or things like that. So you probably do a thorough vetting of your books before they're turned into pages.
Yeah, I usually try to make sure that I always think of the detective story that I wrote. I wrote a couple of those.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
And those took so much research. I mean, I remember once I counted up on a page how many different things I had to research. The guy's just walking down the street and he pulls out his wallet. So I had to research what would he be walking on? Would it be a wooden boardwalk? Would it be cobblestone, whatever? Is there a street lamp? Is that a gas lamp, an electric lamp at this time? You know, is when he pulled out a wallet, would he call it a wallet? Is it a billfold, a notebook, or whatever? What size are the bills at this time? You know, one page, one scene took like 6 or 7 trips down the research rabbit hole. So in 100,000 words, do you miss something? Yeah, it happens.
And those were your S.M. Goodwin mysteries?
Yes.
Too, that came out? Yeah. Probably with everything that you're doing now, there won't be any expectations of more historical mysteries, or is that ideas in a folder somewhere?
Yeah, I've got book ideas for 3 more in that series. Those will be self-published for sure. So at some point in the future.
Well, they were, both of them were fabulous. And I say that from someone who does not like dark, gritty historical mysteries. I tend to read the more genteel kind, but they were truly immersive and very vividly written and such a fascinating time period.
Well, and I felt kind of bad because the first one was so grim. I mean, you know, and it was like even his, I mean, the way I ended it was, I didn't let up on the reader. And the second one, I was much gentler to the reader, although I did leave on a cliffhanger. But I've noticed that I was rereading Gorky Park, which is from the early 80s, right? Mm-hmm. And the difference between Gorky Park and the next book, it was immense. Mm-hmm. You know, that first book was so dense, mm-hmm. and there was so much going on. And then whatever happened between then and the second book, he found his style then. Book was much shorter. Everything was much, you know, pithier. And he narrowed down the focus of the story on, you know, that lead character, Renko.
But will he ever be remembered as much for those books or for Gorky Park, which kind of was his?
Yeah. Yeah. You know, he just wrote his, I have that one. On my list of to read, the recent
Smith, isn't it? Will, no.
Yeah, Martin Cruz Smith.
Yeah,
he's been diagnosed with Parkinson's, so his protagonist Renko has Parkinson's in this latest book. So, be interesting to read it.
Well, we're almost out of time, and I can't believe how quickly it's flown by. Remind us again of a little bit about your new book, The Dueling Duchess, as Minerva Spencer. It's Regency Historical.
Yes, it's book two in the Wild Women of Whitechapel. Mm-hmm. And this is about a female shooter and a gun manufacturer. Probably not the most politically, what would that be called? Incendiary subject right now. This is set in the right at the end of the Napoleonic Wars. And it's about a female circus, an all-female circus. So kind of fun. I think this is a lighter-hearted one than the first one. I know that
The hero is very much
he's a himbo.
Yes.
A himbo. That's my new favorite word.
He doesn't take himself too seriously, I guess.
And it was fun to write that because usually I write these, you know, over-the-top alpha males, but I tell you, he just wasn't going to be that way. He was going to be Mr. Sweetheart. So, yeah. So this is a very feisty heroine who gets some good groveling. If you like groveling, lots of that in this book too. Well-deserved groveling.
And then your indie published title is Balthazar.
Balthazar, yeah. The characters in this series are named after, well, that's a biblical name, but most of them are named after ancient Greek characters. So, and that's the Victorian era, fish out of water, enemies to lovers.
All the popular tropes. And readers can learn more about you and your books through your website, which is
MinervaSpencer.com.
How great. I want to thank Minerva for taking time away from her writing, because just during this conversation, she could have produced at least two books and get some reps out there. And I'd like to thank everyone for tuning into another virtual author chat at the Poison Pen Bookstore. Thank you, Minerva.
Thank you.
Hello. We hope you're enjoying our programs and podcasts with authors. We'd like to expand them, and your help would be appreciated. Please make a donation at poisonedpenfoundation.org. 100% of the proceeds will go to help connect authors with readers in this difficult time. Thank you.